Hello and welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. This is our fortnightly news special. I'm your host today, Ian Gardner, as well as being a co-founder at Innovation Bay. I'm also a venture partner with Gelix Ventures. Being joined today, I've just finished the recording, our panel comprised Kate Hull. Kate is the founder and CEO at Freight Exchange, which is a fantastic Sydney-based startup. Paul Smith is the technology editor at the Australian Financial Review. And we had Evan Hinchcliffe, who's a buddy of ours, a technology industry lead for Macquarie Business Banking. So we had a fantastic discussion. As we've been doing more recently, we go deep on a few topics rather than broad on many. We talked about SPACs. We talked about Madpaws and Airtasker listing last week and the ASX. Macquarie just released a report, Technology Pulse Check 2021. So fascinating insights from a survey they did to with startup founders in the middle of the pandemic. We talked about some cyber security issues. You probably saw that Nine was had a ransomware attack last week. So it was good having Paul there because he went deep on that one. And then we did go deep on a challenging topic, which is the government and their support or lack of, I should say, for women. In fact, that sounds a little prejudiced. It's not meant to be, but it's an observation. And also the treatment of the tech industry by the government. So you probably saw Christian Porter has been put into the tech or the innovation portfolio, taking over from Karen Andrews, who is well-respected champion of women, and a bit of a surprising move, really, and certainly not popular amongst the tech sector. And we go deep on that. So that's a pretty important topic, but quite a challenging one. And a couple of other issues. So we go into that. So just before I jump over to that, just wanted to talk about an event that we've got coming up in a few weeks. So on Tuesday, the 20th of April in the morning, we are hosting an event called Fighting Climate Change with Big Data. Fantastic panel. We've got Stephen Sherwood, who's from UNSW. We've got Kristen Vaughan, who's from the CEFC. So she's been in the podcast just a few weeks ago, if you want to check that out. Christopher Tyler and Martin Widner. So if you want to check out the event page, you'll find it on either Twitter feed or the website. There's still actually a few tickets. We are doing in-person and virtual. So if you can't make it to Sydney, then you will be able to watch. It is at 8 a.m. on Sydney time, that is, on Tuesday the 20th of April. So check it out and hope to see you there. All right, that's enough of the little advertorial. Let's jump over and hear from our panel. Okay, welcome everyone. This is another episode of our fortnightly news special. I have an amazing panel this morning. They're all coming to us from Sydney, in fact. Normally we were all over the country, but let me just give a quick intro to in the order I see them on my screen here. So Kate Hull. Kate, you are a founder at Freight Exchange. Been around a few years now. So, I mean, do you want to just give us a quick update on who you are and what you're up to?
Yeah, you bet. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Freight Exchange. We're a software platform for enterprise to automate the movement of goods between factories to your door, basically, global. We've been live since 2015, and based out of Surry Hills in Sydney.
And the original concept, if I remember, was kind of trying to use up unutilized container space.
Yeah,
but you've kind of pivoted a little bit from there. I mean, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was born out of the discovery that it's a multi-trillion dollar industry, trucking and shipping globally. It's somewhere in the order of $2 trillion US, and it due to inefficiencies, it has not digitized really. It hasn't joined the 21st century like many other industries, and as a result of that, it's really very inefficient. We discovered that there was 30% excess capacity, both in containers and on trucks and on the roads. It was very unsustainable and a somewhat inefficient industry. Yeah, so right. So the platform is there to actually really streamline and digitize the whole industry end to end.
And just quickly before I move on, what stage are you at as a business? I mean, what can you talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we grew some significantly last year, unsurprisingly. Everyone was stuck at home, and there was a very strong demand for freight services, and likewise for technology, which is why it wasn't surprising to read about the article or the study from Macquarie, that a lot of technology companies saw growth and were quite bullish.
All right.
people working from home in the industry, really saw a huge demand spike, and we were no different. Having said that, it was a tough year for supply chains, unsurprisingly. There were no planes and very few ships, and the trucks and the warehouses were very very limited in what they could do. So it was a challenging year.
Yeah. Well, you must be relieved that the Suez Canal took its laxative and removed its constipation. That was not great for the world.
And it was really interesting to read, some people's, that people somewhat understood what happens when you get a significant blockage in any part of a supply chain in the industry. So, that was our year last year. We were just one big Suez Canal.
Yeah. All right. Evan, let me jump to you. So, Evan Hinchcliffe, I've known Evan for a long time now. I think I knew you in a previous life. Technology industry lead for Macquarie Business Banking. So, you are part of Macquarie. Do you want to just give us a little insight into who you are and what you're up to at Macquarie?
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Yeah, no, I think we've known each other since probably 15 years ago.
Oh my God, we're that old.
Yes, so that old. But in the current role, as you said, working inside Macquarie Business Banking, leading our focus around technology there. And so practically what that means is providing financial solutions and business insights for innovative, fast-growing tech companies. And personally, as you alluded to, Ian, I've spent kind of the last two decades prior to Macquarie building and working in technology companies. So hoping I can bring some of that real-world experience to those in the Australian technology ecosystem who are looking to scale up.
And we'll probably get into this a bit later, but I mean, in terms of ambitions and goals for your role at Macquarie, like what are you hoping to see for the, you know, because you kind of focus in the tech sector and startups, I guess.
So in terms of what we cover and Macquarie's probably a little different in the way we approach things. So we look to cover top to bottom of the market in what we do, but in a very niche area. So technology being one of those niches. So I think everything from probably Series A up to large corporates and listed. And as you and I have kind of chatted about it in previous forums, we really like what Silicon Valley Bank or SVB have done in the US over the last 20, 30 years and think there's a real opportunity for something similar. Obviously, the nuance is the Australian economy, but something similar in the Australian market as well. So SVB for Australia, if you want kind of a soundbite, is this kind of what we're having to do over the next period of time.
We're my, in fact, Innovation Bay and Gelix hat. We've moved our accounts to Macquarie in the last couple of years, and it's been great. People answer the phone, they care, and they solve your problems. So it's pretty good. And you are also a sponsor of us, which is not the reason you're on, but it's much appreciated because you have been, Macquarie, as a wider group, has been a sponsor of Innovation Bay for a number of years now, and it's been a really good relationship. All right, next up, Paul Smith, second time on the show, I believe, Paul. So Paul is the technology editor at the AFR that we've probably all heard of. Paul's also been on the actual podcast. So if you go back in the archives, you can hear Paul and I having a chat. When was that?
Is this an unofficial?
Well, no, this is the news podcast. So we kind of differentiate the two. This is not the unofficial rogue. This is not the Pirate Bay of podcasts. But I can't remember when that was. It must be 2 years ago, maybe more.
Yeah, well, I was in the city, so it's at least a year ago.
Yeah, yeah, at least. And yeah, how's it been for you this last year, Paul?
Look, it sounds very glib, but I've actually really enjoyed it. I like working from home. I like the option of going in the city, which obviously we've got back now. I live a bit outside Sydney, so about an hour and a half outside of Sydney. So I've been working from home for the best part of the last 12 months, but things are opening back up again. Lots of people back in the office for the Fin Review now moved to North Sydney, but then we obviously got hit by a cyber attack. So now we're all back working from home again. So we're all well prepared for it now, but it's quite a nice way to work if you can get in to see people when you need to and also have your space to write and think about your stories and not be hassled when you want to just stay at home and write. That works well as well, and you also get to see your kid a lot more.
Yeah, there you go. That's important. You got to do that. And how's the publishing industry been? Has it been hit like COVID response or COVID impact?
We've done really well. Subscriber numbers have gone. I haven't got the figures to hand, but we've had plenty of articles that we've written bragging about our success, where the subscriber numbers have really gone up. Lots of people have been looking for news, obviously, in times of upheaval, and yeah, it's been really good for us. And the AFR has done really well and continues to grow. We've obviously had lots of inward-looking news coverage in the last 6 months or so, maybe less than that, with the ACCC code of conduct, where it came a bit of a battle about old media, so to speak, versus the online giants, and that was obviously an interesting story to cover, and interesting to be within the tech sphere, seeing how people reacted to that story was interesting as well. So yeah, it's certainly been a quieter time in terms of not being out and about in the city, but a fun time in terms of all the stuff that's going on.
Yep. All right. Thank you, everyone, for that quick intro. Let's maybe talk about some news. We're going to kick off with talking about SPACs. So special purpose acquisition company. It's been around for a while, but it's kind of taken center stage in many ways. And, you know, the number of SPACs has just risen dramatically, and the number of IPOs has fallen equally dramatically in many ways. So the US, it seems to be everywhere. And you know, every time you open a paper, then you're reading about it. And the one that I think we zeroed in on was WeWork. So they had a sort of fairly disastrous failed IPO last year. I think they were trying to list it $47 billion, and it was just embarrassing and didn't work. But now they've kind of got away with a SPAC deal that's going to take them public. So, that was in the Wall Street Journal. But Paul, I'm sure you've covered SPACs and some of the stuff that's going on there. So do you want to just give the journalist perspective and what you're seeing in the world of SPACs?
From my perspective at the AFR, a lot of what we have covered about this so far is the fact that you can't have SPACs on the ASX. The ASX has actually spoken quite reasonably about why that's the case. There was obviously rules in place from a long time ago about sort of cash box companies that have never done particularly well locally. I interviewed, I'm trying to remember his name now, I'm speaking publicly, Patrick Grove, who's a sort of well-known entrepreneur who's based over in Singapore at the moment, but Australian-based as well, has done really well with tech companies in Australia in the past. He was launching a SPAC over in the US, which was targeting Australian companies. I interviewed him a little while back, and that was exciting for us because there hasn't really been any local activity. But from my perspective, I can understand why they aren't available here. I was at the AFR's banking summit last week, and I was speaking to people about that because I thought maybe it'd be an interesting story idea, and someone that works in the VC space and knows a lot more about it than me was sort of saying to me, well, a lot of the appeal for SPACs from a founder startup perspective is it's a way to get listed without all of the hassle, but it's not exactly hard to list in Australia. When you look at some of the companies that list really early in their life, there's obviously different requirements that come from it, but it's nowhere near as difficult to list here as it is in the US. And we have a fairly checkered recent history with backdoor listings. Yeah. I know SPACs are different to backdoor listings, but they're certainly in the same ballpark in a way. And I can see why there's reticence about just opening up the doors and letting them go on, because it's in many ways, it's not really needed. But I can also see why founders might love the idea of a less hassle listing and being bought out for lots of money, and also VCs from that point of view. So I don't have a firm view either way of whether it should happen or shouldn't, but I understand why it doesn't.
Yeah. And Evan, I mean, has Macquarie got a perspective on this one? Like, yeah, give us some insight from where you're sitting.
Yeah, so speaking from a business banking perspective, so we don't do capital markets or IPOs or that kind of piece. That's another part of the group. But anecdotally, what I'd say is that when we're engaging with these fast-growing companies, we see a couple of areas that probably require a bit of focus as they scale, and I think this applies to a lot of companies, not just technology companies looking to grow. And the first would be maturity in the finance function, so timely and accurate financial statements and commentary. And the second is appropriate governance structures, so I think having the board and reporting and so forth in place. So I think while I see the benefits that sponsors, those behind the SPACs, would spruik to founders and entrepreneurs, I think equally needs to be that focus on outside investors and the public market needs to be key considerations as well.
And Kate, from a founder's perspective, is there, I mean, you've been fairly pragmatic, I think, because it's fair to say with your fundraising and looking at this stuff, but is this just crazy? Like, what's going on?
Look, it certainly gives the perception that they're a lot riskier than going through an IPO. And I can certainly see it from a founder's perspective. Anything that makes raising capital easier is definitely an attractive and appealing prospect. But it's certainly not something that, is really on my radar, most certainly. I would be curious to hear about the AU roll-up, though. That's certainly an interesting, with Patrick Grove, and that's certainly an interesting...
Sorry to interrupt you, Kate. Yeah, he just came to us with that, to be honest. Said, I'm doing this thing, I'm raising all this money, and I think it was, he was looking to raise about $300 million US dollars. To buy out a company. And when you look at that kind of valuation to then go listing in the US, there's not huge number of companies that you'd think would be on his radar, but I guess he was talking about maybe looking at, he was talking to the AFR, so he was highlighting the Australian angle, but I guess he's shopping all over Asia as well. But it's a fun story. And if they happen as a journalist, these are easy stories to write because they're people with lots of money shopping around and you get to play guess who they're going to buy. I think we've seen stories, I think it was in the SMH or the Age. I hope it wasn't the FR from giving credit to other papers, but I think it was the SMH and the Age talking about Airwallex being approached by SPACs on a fairly regular basis. But I think their valuation, they'd be maybe even out of reach for some of these by now anyway. So, yeah, I don't know who the companies would be.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of money has been raised. I think the last I looked, it was almost $50 billion just this year, which is just an insane amount of money. I think the thing that struck it home to me was, like, if you think back to the crazy dot-com boom, which some of us in the room will be old enough to remember, when companies were IPOing just on the back of an idea. I think the biggest month for IPOs then was $5 billion. And then you're seeing SPACs raising at, 20 plus billion in just a month, the same frequency. So I don't know, it just feels there's a lot of cash out there. It's looking for a home. Interest rates are low. You know, is there a complete dynamical change in the macroeconomic environment, or are we heading for something that we, don't want to see? Well, sure.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at all the GameStop stuff and it's where it's become a bit of a game. And then you also look at the real fear of missing out that you often see amongst Australian investors. You see real roller coaster. As soon as a relatively small tech company lists, you see these massive rises and falls because it's either going to be huge and people are terrified to miss out, or, oh my God, there's something not quite right. It's a disaster. Everyone bail. So there's still a bit of immaturity in the retail investment market and maybe some of the institutional investment market in Australia as well.
Yeah.
SPACs would certainly just add another angle to that, where we just get to write nice stories with lovely big numbers in a financial tabloid. So,
all right. Well, let's bring the focus back to Australia. So a couple of fairly high profile tech startup listings on the ASX last week, which was great to see. Madpaws, which is a, Airbnb for pets. I think that's basically how it started, but they're branching out into a few other things. They listed, I think currently they're down a little bit on last week, I think sitting about $40 billion in valuation. So it's not a huge listing. In my view, that's maybe a little subscale to be a listed business, but good on them for getting it away. And also Airtasker. So Tim Fung's been a sort of key player in the Sydney or the Australian startup scene for a number of years now. Amazing backstory, and just he actually spoke at an Innovation Bay dinner a long time ago, and just some really, really good insights as to how he started the business and raised the money and did everything. So he's amazing to see that get away. They're a little bit up, so $500 million. Both of them trading around, I think it's about 30 times forward revenue, which is a lot of value in there. So who should we start with here? Kate, any views on this one? You and I talked about this before we switched the mics on. No, you had some views.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're obviously delighted for both of them. I think they're setting really fantastic precedents. And yeah, well, I suppose we were just reflecting on how their valuations, appeared relative to other similar business models, such as Freelancer, how they're trading relative to their revenue multiples. Actually, interesting, as you were just speaking, Ian, it looks like Airbnb is trading at about 30 times revenue. With both of those new listings trading at similar types of multiples, it's good on them.
But your point, Freelancers is right. So poor old Matt Barry, he's sitting at about a $300 million valuation on revenue of 50. So he's at 6 times forward revenue. So I don't know why he's getting penalized, because it looks like a very similar business to MadPause and Airtasker to me. Anyway, I should disclose at the start, this is not a stock trading advice or anything else. I don't want anyone pinging us about, I took your advice and bought Freelancer because it's undervalued. I'm not saying that. I don't think any of us are saying that. So,
no. It's also been around a long time, but you know what it's like. It's new.
Yeah. Matt has been around for a long time. He listed in 2013. And he was one of the very first tech company or startup company IPOs that we had. Any thoughts on that, Paul?
I don't know. With Airtasker, I mean, I liked him. I've spoken to him many times over the journey so far. I always say this. I don't know what the basis of some of the valuations are when you compare one company to another. I guess the potential people see is for a global growth, but I'm not sure Airtasker is growing internationally or is likely to become a big global brand or not. Maybe it will, but it's certainly hugely competitive if they do. It's good to see, I guess, that it really pops, but you then also say, well, did they underprice the IPO? And then get lots of good stories about surging share prices, because it's certainly a lot higher than when they listed, which is great and a success story in one sense. But also, if you're one of the people already invested, you think, well, you left a lot of value on the table there for me. Thanks a lot. It's always good to see a company doing well, and we need more sort of big brand tech companies, because I think a lot of the storytelling and the image of tech in Australia so far, some of the big success stories have been in a crude sense rather boring companies, which don't have a really strong sort of public focus of what people actually know what they are and think, well, that's been created here. Airtasker is a really easy brand for people to understand and see what can be built here, which is, I guess, a case with lots of marketplace models.
Yeah.
But I've had my toilet fixed by someone on Airtasker. And I guess a lot of people have to go, oh, Airtasker.
Is it still working?
So where a lot of times say, our big superstars at Atlassian, you ask most people in the street what they do. They know something to do with the environment. it's good to have these more sort of consumer brands on there in terms of awareness of an industry where, obviously great to have more sort of functional and useful technology being built here as well. But it's good and it's interesting for us as journalists. We love to see companies growing, and rise and fall is all good drama.
And Evan, are you, there seems to be a bit of glut's the wrong word, but there's quite a few companies coming to market. It seems, the IPO window is open. It's probably the way of putting it. I mean, how bullish are you on the next few months for the tech industry? With view to IPOs or not?
Not in the capital markets business from a core perspective, but anecdotally, we're seeing a lot of M&A activity happening. So whether that's private markets, VCs doing secondaries, private equity buying in, or companies looking at a run at the boards, definitely a lot of demand there. I think more broadly, as we've talked about in terms of e-commerce and marketplaces, I don't know, we'll jump into this later in the conversation, but there was a real one of the big winners out of COVID was that e-commerce and marketplace business. We're all kind of stuck at home, as Paul mentioned as well, getting someone near Tasker to come fix the bathroom. Had plenty of friends and family who kind of moved during COVID, and whether it was everything from organizing the move to put the IKEA unit together to move the couch, et cetera. There were plenty of those personal stories I think we all had, of which really demonstrated the value and ease with which people are using these marketplaces.
All right, let's stick with you, Evan. So, I mean, Macquarie has released a report, the Technology Pulse Check 2021, which I'll get you to comment on in a sec. But essentially, you went out and surveyed, I think, 130 startup founders, in the middle of COVID. So I think it was August, September last year, you went out with the research. So it was right in the guts of the Melbourne lockdown, and everyone's sort of a little bit white knuckled and nervous. But some pretty interesting anecdotes or insights that we saw there. So I don't know what headlines we'll start with. I mean, tech was the COVID winner. We've talked about that on this show before, but you've actually got some data to show that. Aussies need to learn to sell. And employee engagement is crucial for growth. Yeah, Evan, you were a co-author in this report. So, tell us about what you found.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. It was a really interesting piece of research that we put together. As you noted, it was at the crux of when we did our kind of field research of the second lockdown in Melbourne. So we were hopeful that the people were sitting around and had some time, but equally, as we talked about before the mics were on, I think everyone was a bit over SurveyMonkey by that stage, and everyone kind of pinging founders and tech company owners to say what's happening in your world. People just wanted to get on with their business. But no, the results of the survey really surprised us at one level, but also just shored up what we thought was happening in the place around technology, and kind of really encouraged us as we look to support businesses in that space. I think some of just the headline numbers that we saw was that nearly three quarters of survey respondents reported revenues either flat or growing. And if we have this against the background of flat was probably the new up in 2020, we had nearly two-thirds or 63% turning a profit, and one in five had a healthy margin a profit margin of 20% or greater. So some really strong stats there. And it was, we're talking about businesses that have probably been on average running for about 7 years. So ARR of 10 mil, almost 11 mil across those that we surveyed. So again, as I think we chatted about this prior to this conversation, that's a pretty solid number for businesses at that stage. In their journey.
And Kate, I know you've had a read of this. Like, any from a founder's perspective, anything surprising in there?
There was one thing that wasn't surprising, and that is how tech companies did grow and how bullish they are coming out of COVID. Certainly, to do a shameless plug, when everyone's stuck at home or there's not so many people allowed into the office. Being able to digitize and work from anywhere and have a lot greater visibility over your business is something that we had customers coming to us and demanding our services, where previously we do have to go out there and sell. So that certainly wasn't much of a surprise. That was actually really fantastic to hear that everyone was quite bullish. I suppose I was quite surprised by the employee engagement piece. I think most startups, and certainly it's our experience, we run very, very lean, and as such, you do have to have a tight knit employee, company. You have to have a tight knit bunch of team members. And so I was quite surprised to hear that there were concerns in that area. But we don't really have the budgets for huge training and development and so on. So I suppose that's the part of the explanation.
Yeah, I mean, one of the tables that was interesting to me was the sort of self-rated performance. Interestingly, Macquarie is great because it does reports across a bunch of different industries. So it's done, you know, real estate, legal, insolvency, built environment, and asked the participants to rank themselves, you know, against customer centricity, vision and strategy, innovation, and a bunch of other ones. Tech founders are the most confident or deluded, I'm not sure which, in pretty much every category except the people orientation. So I think, is that right, Evan? Am I reading that data correctly?
Yeah, no, you've interpreted that correctly. Yeah, no, I'd go with confident rather than self-deluded. we're here to support the ecosystem.
Correct.
Not to tear it down. And so I think, yeah, as Kate mentioned, it's a really interesting paradox, those two. And again, as we were chatting before, the mics are on, and I've known you for a number of years, and we first met when we're a CEO at a small company, and so Kate empathised in terms of that piece where it is a small team. I think I was employee number four of a very small business, which was later sold to Maya. But yeah, at the time you'd be wearing multiple hats and just getting through the day. This time 16 years ago, a little pager and was on call for any service alerts. This was in the days before AWS and just spinning up servers. You had to manage all the kit yourself. So totally get that. But again, this was not a Macquarie view on things. This was respondents self-selecting in terms of the focus around that. And so I think rather than sort of saying this is a bad thing, it is a really great opportunity for businesses, particularly tech business, to think about what they can be doing around that EX or employee experience piece. As you said, Kate, this is not being a big company and having fancy events and things like that. It's that time and investing in those key employees, and that certainly our experience is that pays back multiples in the customer experience piece and the revenue that then generates.
And in terms of looking forward, I mean, I think one of the questions you asked is, well, what are you focused on? And I think the takeaways were, one, raising money, and two, hiring better or more people, which are kind of, you know, the two headaches of most high growth tech startups. Those are the two that we normally come up with. So, Paul, any thoughts on this one or what you're saying?
That was interesting because, I mean, didn't you say, Evan, that you did the survey during the height of lockdown? And because we've since interviewed plenty of founders that have talked about the fact that they were either forced to cut staff during that period and have obviously rehired people as well, or were under immense pressure from their investors telling them that you should be cutting staff. We had a story in the paper this week as we're recording with a capital raising for a company called Onboarder, who the founder was saying that he resisted calls by their investors to lay off staff. You know, that all the VC advice was cut fast, cut hard. They didn't, and they're really glad they didn't, because they're now trying to hire people and things didn't slow down as much as they thought. So maybe if you're interviewing people about how they feel about their engagement when they're scared that they're about to be tapped on the shoulder, perhaps explains why they're not feeling particularly loved by their organization. And now the love's probably flown back to them when they know that they've got a job for the next couple of years at least.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. Fair comment, Evan. I'll maybe leave the last word with you, and then we'll move on to a new one. So, I mean, one of the things that talking about the fundraising piece, because obviously that's crucial, and you ran through sort of three options or three standard options that startups look at. So, bootstrap, property backed loans, which for most people just gives them the heebie-jeebies. It's probably not the best way. Equity investing, which is the sort of standard way of raising money. But yeah, you talk about a fourth way that you're spotting. So do you want to just touch on that?
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Yeah, so I think, again, these are all legitimate ways of raising capital that the first three you talked about. And I have huge admiration for those who kind of bootstrap businesses. Got some good friends who've bootstrapped and built and successfully sold a number of SaaS businesses. So appreciate that model. The property piece, often a financier will say, and this is more in terms of traditional finance, that they want to take the deeds to your personal property to secure the business. And then the third one is an equity piece. But what we're seeing more is what we call the fourth way, and that's looking at providing debt, so non-dilutive funding into businesses. And what we see different here is, so debt has been a dirty word historically, and I was listening to some folks on the A16Z podcast recently, so the Andreessen Horowitz podcast. But people like talking about what they're spending things on, but not necessarily on what they're indebted to. So that kind of really resonated for me. And so debt has been a bit of a dirty word, but we find that just having the conversation with founders and entrepreneurs out there that one, they didn't know it was available, and two, their assumption is that you're going to take the deeds to the home, whereas we take very much we understand the business, as we outlined at the top of the conversation. We've been in the space for 20 years. We've run technology businesses. We understand how those businesses fundamentally run, so we take a view on the business and back the business and the founder, the entrepreneur, to generate the cash flow to service the loan.
Because historically, the big banks have not really supported debt, because I mean you're right, it's, unless you've got a property or something that the bankers can get their head around, they don't tend to want to do it. But it's different now, because you know, long-term sticky SaaS renewable income from multiple sources is actually a pretty safe bet. Is that kind of the punchline?
Yeah, thinking about the underlying business, you know, whether it's SaaS or IT services or digital infrastructure, again, we look at the underlying earnings, the ability for those to be highly recurring. And we're taking a view on those earnings, absolutely.
All right, look, let's keep going. We're half an hour in. So cybersecurity, Paul, it's good that you're here, because Nine, which owns the AFR, amongst other assets, had a bit of an incident in the last few weeks and caused a bit of a internal problem. So do you want to give us your perspective on that and what you're seeing in the cyber world?
Oh, well... It's been a hugely disruptive experience for everyone that works for Nine. We were
actually, what happened?
Well, as far as we know, it was a ransomware attack, although there's been no sort of reported ransom or anything like that. But essentially, in the dead of night over the weekend, the system started acting funny and weren't working properly on a Sunday morning. And of course, we're the publishing side of the business at the Financial Review, but there's also the TV side of the business, which has live TV shows to put out, and they couldn't put some shows out on the Sunday. But as people know with cyber attacks, when they come into the system, they then spread themselves all over, and any systems that you that interact with each other, you have to sort of try and segregate and stop the and clear it out before you put them live again. So it's basically, at the moment, as we record this, the company is still functioning in a sort of, I wouldn't, maybe not crisis mode, but an unusual mode where people are using workarounds, VPNs and different ways to access the system, being advised not to go into the office if they don't have to, because it puts loads on the system. But the newspapers are still getting put out. TV shows are still being broadcast. So you'd have to say that the internal tech team at Nine are handling it as well as they could be. But yeah, it's hugely disruptive. We don't know where in the world it's come from. It looks like it's probably some criminal gang that's looking to try and reap some kind of financial reward, rather than being some kind of state-based hacking to stop us revealing secrets or anything like that. But who knows, really? We kind of, as a journalist, I'm reporting on it as if I don't work at the company, because I think that's the best way you have to do these kind of things. Otherwise, you become a bit of a PR mouthpiece and you just report as much as you can. And no company likes to give away too much information, because they're trying to fix problems, not highlight them.
Yeah. And even if you do pay a ransom, no one wants to admit it, because that's in some ways, the worst thing you can do. But in some ways, it's the only thing you can do.
Yeah, there's a few things about it. It's not hugely clear whether you're actually breaking the law by doing so, because you're funding crime. But I think it's an unspoken thing in many industries that people know that lots of people do pay ransoms. Otherwise, that people wouldn't keep asking for them. And There's certainly been reported cases where universities in Europe have paid ransoms in order to get access to research that have been locked away. And you can understand it because, I mean, we're creating stuff every day, but if it's your life works locked away there and they're saying, well, we're just going to delete it, or you can pay us a fee, then it's definitely tempting to do it. But like you say, you don't know what happens if you do pay a ransom. Do they genuinely leave all your systems? Do they keep hold of any information they've got hold of to use again? Do they just come back and ask for another ransom?
My understanding is that they tend to be quite smart and savvy commercial operators. So it's like,
businesses.
They've got to keep their customers happy. Yeah. So if they
want the word of mouth out there that if you pay the ransom, you get a good customer service. Yeah. So it's kind of strange, really.
It is. It's bonkers. Kate, any experience with this, or have you been attacked?
Look, people are always trying, certainly, with denial of service attacks. But, I mean, there were certainly in the last sort of 3 or 4 years that we've been operating, FedEx under the brand of TNT, had a very well publicized outage, took all of its global systems out for, the best part of several months. Likewise, Toll Logistics last year was the subject of a significant attack, and all of their systems were well and truly out for the best part of three to six months. And to my knowledge, there were no ransoms paid. It was just a pure malware attack, and the systems went out, and that was that. And everything went back to operating on paper for a long, long time. So it's definitely incredibly disruptive. And it's also, kudos to Nine for being resilient enough to bounce back, because certainly those two companies mentioned suffered significant losses as a result of those attacks. So,
Evan, I mean, you work at the biggest company here. I mean, there must be pretty rigorous processes in place to protect Macquarie. Any insight on this or what you're seeing in the startup world around cybersecurity?
Yeah, I can't talk to our operational procedures, as you'd appreciate, but what we're seeing in the community, we're pretty closely connected to it in that we bank the clients in my portfolio, a number of companies who work in the space. So they've been very busy over recent times. But it's not just the providers in the space or large organisations that we've talked to just now. As we saw in our survey as well, I think something over 16% of respondents had cybersecurity as a risk to the growth of their business. So it's kind of something that covers all kind of segments of the market. And I think as Paul alluded to as well, we need to think about this as a business model. Ransomware particularly is designed to get a particular outcome. It's not a particular technology, not a particular person or actor. It's a business model, and as Paul alluded to, people kind of pay up. And so there's been a kind of market price discovery kind of piece there historically.
It's a tricky one. It's beyond two-factor authentication, which we should all be doing, and don't click on any malicious links, which you should know better about. I mean, that's probably the toughest one. It's that social engineering. It looks like a legit email from someone that you think you know, and then you click on it. And then, there's different sorts of cybersecurity fraud coming in as well, like the invoice spoofing. So they grab the invoice and they just change the bank details that you're meant to be paying to. And then, hey, presto, your money's gone to someone else and you can't get it back. But look, there is an investment opportunity, and it is good to see some great Aussie cybersecurity companies. I mean, I can't rattle them all off, but I know Casada is pretty amazing and fast growing, and quite a few others. So I don't know whether the Australians are world class in this area, but I know that they are good, and there's some strong businesses out there. So,
I think you interviewed Malcolm Turnbull not too long ago, didn't you? And he's certainly into investing in cyber. So he's picked that as a specialty to invest in as a sort of startup investor. He's done a couple of cyber security investments.
Yeah, I think that's right. I might get this wrong, but I'm pretty sure he's in Casada. Maybe I'm wrong.
He is.
Yes, right. Oh, good. Thank you for clarifying. All right, well, I'll maybe use that as a segue to talk about some other government stuff. Yeah, so the industry portfolio for the government seems to be a bit of a pass the parcel. You know, we seem to have had more industry ministers than Italian prime ministers over the last few years. I mean, it's just been this revolving door of people coming in or out. Karen Andrews, I think she'd been there for a little while, and I think was very competent, in fact, probably too competent because she got promoted to a new portfolio. I've got to be careful about how I express this, but, you know, Christian Porter, you know, rightly or wrongly, he is a tarnished good. I mean, he's been accused of rape, which he denies, and it's been a tough road for him, but the government's still behind him, but he is now in the technology portfolio. Now, there's been quite a few articles have come out. Paul, I think you and your team have done a great job on this, and there was one out today just talking about how, you know, Emily Rich, who's the director of startups for Microsoft, has gone on the record saying, we're not going to meet with Christian Porter. And the government needs to know better that they can't just hand us some, you know, someone like Christian Porter that we've got to try and deal with. I mean, it's pretty nuanced here. I might start with you, Paul, and then get your insight, Kate. So, Paul, what's going on? What are you seeing from your perspective?
Well, it's certainly a very unusually strong reaction. We do we call them reacts stories in the paper, where people are reacting to some news. And whenever there's a new minister or the budget, you go to a whole heap of people and say, "What do you think?" And it's normally a job of finding anyone saying anything interesting, because everyone plays it safe and no one wants to come out and criticize a minister because they're going to have to deal with them. And no one wants to come out and say something bad about the government because they maybe want to get some grants or some funding from them down the track. So to have people coming out, as they did in the piece written by my colleague Yolanda today, saying, we're not going to meet with this guy, we don't think he's an appropriate person to be the minister under the current circumstances. And also an interesting point that Daniel Petrie from Airtree Ventures said, we don't think he can be properly focused on the role with all the other stuff going on. And it kind of indicates that the portfolio isn't being given the profile it should be within the government. They're all very valid points, which I'm hopeful that the government will address when we try and speak to them about it. But certainly, Emily at Microsoft speaking out obviously did so. It's a brave thing to do to speak out when you work for a big company. You used to work for AWS, and I'm sure you trod the tightrope when you were there sometime about speaking publicly about issues that the company wouldn't be particularly keen on you talking about.
Yeah, I was probably a bit of a blabbermouth. Like, the PR team used to get cold sweats when I would speak, so it's probably quite good that I'm not there anymore.
And so look, it was really impressive that she spoke out, and she certainly, I think it's certainly been a very popular story with AFR readers today. It's gone live when we record this. It went live overnight, and it's one of the most read stories on the website, and sort of social media engagement is very high, obviously, and lots of people saying that this is a really important story that people are talking about, not questioning the guilt or innocence in relation to the actual case itself, but just whether this is the right appointment to be making in these circumstances in an industry that notoriously already has a problem with engagement with women, women in roles existing and going into the industry, and whether this is the right message to be sending about the person that's responsible.
Let's get Kate's insight here. I mean, Kate, this industry has a problem anyway, just with trying to encourage more women participation and women raising money. Is just it's just really hard for women in this sector, you know. And we've been handed a sort of double shit sandwich here, because Karen Andrews was good. I mean, like, one, she was female; two, she was an engineer; three, she really supported women. She was, you know, appointed a woman in STEM ambassador. She announced an $18 million fund that I think boosting female founders program. She was well respected and regarded, and suddenly we're being handed an accused rapist. You know, and right, again, I should clarify, he denies it, and it's right or wrong, but unfortunately it's tarnished goods, and we feel like we're getting the rough end of the stick. So yeah, your perspective, Kate?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, certainly it is very much a rough end of the stick. you know, I think, Paul, your point about Emily speaking out, I think we're actually seeing a real turning point on this issue in terms of, you know, historically, you know, there's most people keep allegations of rape and rampant misogyny secret, and it's been allowed to thrive in that silence, I suppose. So you know, it's good to see that even in enterprise and in areas where people would not normally speak out, you're seeing that in comments in the press. So I think it speaks to how strongly a lot of women, especially in business, are feeling. Not just STEM, if I'm honest. I think I'm sure one of the things about the appointment of Christian Porter to any cabinet position is that, you know, if he was in any other industry, perhaps maybe with the exception of Hollywood, he would probably be expected to do the right thing and step down and step aside while the matters were dealt with. And you know, I think that is now the appropriate thing to do. I don't think there's many people in any other industries who would, you know, who would get a bit of a demotion and, you know, and off they go.
Yeah.
So, and I'm also disappointed that Karen Andrews wasn't replaced with a woman. You know, I think there's still nowhere near parity in the cabinet in gender. There's nowhere near parity in STEM in terms of gender equality. So, yeah, there's a lot of work to do. So I'm not surprised that there's been strong reactions.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, Kate, do you have to deal much with the government in your role as a founder? Do you on any of the sort of programs for grants, that kind of thing? And does this change how you view that?
Firstly, we were awarded the Boosting Female Founder Grant that Karen Andrews instigated. And I was, it goes without saying, I was completely delighted by that. And also by the recognition. So it feels like it's one step forward, two steps back, because Karen Andrews has recognised that female founders, you know, have the ability to raise significantly less capital typically than our male counterparts. I think the stats are, I don't know them off the top of the head, but Ian, you probably do. They're, what is it, 2% of all capital is raised?
Oh, it's terrible. And it got worse during COVID.
So anyway, I found that grant and receiving that grant, whether we did or not, I just thought it was actually really a fantastic movement for female founders. I don't think it will change the way I interact. I don't interact heavily with the government, Paul, and so it won't really change the way that we do business. Obviously, we're grateful for every penny that comes our way, though.
Mm. I mean, Paul, I don't want to turn this into the politics show, but, you know, any insights on what's going to happen? I mean, this is a scandal or a topic that's just not going away.
No more insights than you would have, really. I have my opinions on what should happen and whether it's a positive move for the sector. I don't think necessarily, even without any of the terrible accusations and the sexual assault side of things, I don't necessarily think he would have been a great appointment as the technology minister. And it's never been an area that he's particularly been engaged with. I think he's always had ambitions for you know, moving to the prime ministership, and rightly or wrongly, I think for me, AG position that he had before to the tech minister is seen internally in Canberra as a demotion. And I don't think you want a minister in a position that views it as a demotion. You want someone, if it is considered a junior ministry, which is right or wrong, then you want someone on the rise in that kind of position, someone that wants to make things happen and want to make a difference. You don't really want someone that's been parked away and is clearly not going to be wheeled out to any events or many big announcements because they're terrified that they're going to be asked about things that they don't want to talk about on the record.
Yeah.
So you just have to think that the portfolio is going to be under a big cloth until the next election, because you can't imagine that he's going to turn up to many events where there's going to be people asking questions.
Yeah. And last word with you on this one, Kate. I mean, if Christian Porter and Scott Morrison are listening, what would you say to them?
Oh, how long have we got? I don't think I've got much. Honestly, it's been quite flabbergasting to see how. I think the word tin-eared has been bandied about fairly frequently, and I think that's putting it politely. I'd have to say it's been eye-opening to see. How little these issues seem to concern the Prime Minister or Christian Porter.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to, maybe we've got time for a couple more stories that are a little more uplifting than that one. But that was an important topic that I think we had to cover. So there was a story, it's about a fund called Second Quarter Ventures. We talked about it in a previous episode, I think, but they have gone public with a $51 million secondary fund called Second Quarter Ventures. You know, they're talking about offering founders life-changing wealth. So the idea is that they will come in and buy out early investors. So in the old days, the only way you could get your cash out of a startup was either through an acquisition, pulling your cash when everyone's selling, or an IPO. Now there's this emerging route of a secondary market. So, which is really encouraging. So, Evan, we haven't heard from you for a little while. So, what do you make of Second Quarter, and how exciting is having secondary money in the market?
Yeah, no, I think secondary funds and Second Quarter kind of breaking ground in Australia is a fantastic thing. As I think we're all aware, those kind of funds have been active in the US for a period of time, but Australia, based on the tech ecosystems, probably a few steps behind where Silicon Valley are at. But yeah, it's really great that they're there. And I think from a personal perspective as well, like if early investors and founders are able to realize some of their gains, especially if the investors then to be able to feed that back into the next stage of funding, the seed and pre-seed rounds as well, then that's only a good thing for the growth of the tech ecosystem in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they've gone public with a couple of announcements. So they've done Propeller, which is a StartMate business, great business, you know, raised quite a chunk of money from Blackbird, and Accel, I think, put some money in there as well. And they've also done ActivePipe, which is a real estate marketing platform. So, Kate, as a founder here, like having secondary options come in, is this good for you or your early investors?
Yeah, it's great news. It's quite like the debt financing as well. You know, it just indicates that the industry as a whole that they're recognizing the opportunity to finance these actually legitimate businesses. it's really positive. And certainly, I suppose it's quite similar to the Blackbird secondary funding that they...
Oh, the strip sale?
Yeah.
I guess in a sense, I mean that went straight to the pockets of the Blackbird LPs rather than the early investors in specific companies, but I guess the principle's the same.
Yeah.
Which is healthy.
So definitely positive.
Yeah, I loved in the story that we wrote about this fund. Ash Faruji, I think his surname is, the founder of ActivePipe, one of the companies that you mentioned that they've invested in. He was just really open about this is a life changing thing for him as a founder. He'd been putting in the crazy hours that you do with a young family, and saying one day this is all going to pay off. But, you know, you see valuations of startups, but it's all on paper.
Yeah.
But now at least some of that's in his bank account, and he doesn't have to worry that it's all going to go up in a puff of smoke one day. He's actually got some of the money to realize the value for the work that he's putting in whilst he's still growing the business. Obviously, it's not all sold out or anything like that, but it's just really clear that such a massive difference to the way he can now think and relax on one area of his life and really focus on that without worrying about if this all blows up, I'm going to be left with nothing.
Yep. All right. Well, that's awesome news. Yeah, Kate, what were you saying?
A little bit linked to the employee engagement piece. As well, you know, the ability to have lots of different funding opportunities gives you, again, the ability for employees with ESOPs and so on to actually feel that they've got, skin in the game that can legitimately be converted to cash at some point as well. So, you know, it all layers into good things for the industry.
All right, let's take one quick other story, which we probably won't have time to go deep on, but one of our buddies in the the venture capital ecosystem, Tempus Partners, which was founded by Al Coleman. They've renamed. They're calling themselves Folklore Ventures. And at the same time, they have promoted Hannah Field. So Hannah was actually on the podcast, I think, just over a year ago. She's an amazing character, great background. Take a listen to it because it's really good. And it's amazing to see one of the bigger and better profiled companies actually promoting talent like that. So, you know, the ranks of female GPs in the venture capital world is not great. So this kind of goes in counter to our Christian Porter story. So, Kate, any thoughts on that? Like, are you more predisposed if a VC's got a female partner?
Oh, it's like the funding story. It's all fantastic for the industry. You know, the more diversity that we have in the ecosystem, the better. You know, it's and Tempus Partners, you know, Alistair and their mission of, you know, filling in that gap around the Series A. Is also, you know, really helpful as well because there is a gap.
Yeah.
In that space. So yeah, it's great.
And Evan, you've known these guys for a while. So any thoughts on Folklore?
You know, we've known Al and for a period of time, and I think to Kate's point as well, like the technology is has a diversity problem, and so particularly in the GP space, we think that's fantastic. Obviously, the likes of Michelle Deaker doing great things at One Ventures, but yeah, I think getting Hannah promoted to a full partner in there is only additive to the whole industry.
Yeah, there's an amazing
name change in. I mean, you've named VC funds. What did you name Jellix?
We did. And I was just going to comment on that. I mean, like an amazing woman founder and GP there, Andrea Gardner. I'm a little bit biased, but she's pretty awesome. Sorry, Paul, what were you saying?
I was just going to say, how did you guys come up with the name? I mean, they've obviously changed from Tempest to, was it Folklore? I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's probably a little more. Andrea talks about wanting to do it for the family. So our kids are called Jasper and Felix. So it's kind of...
That's nice. That's a good reason. That's a good reason. And Airtree is Daniel and Craig's names combined as well, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, like naming companies, I mean, who'd have thought of Google or Diageo? I mean, where on earth did they come from? All right, look, we are out of time, unfortunately, but that was a fascinating journey around the startup news and political news. So look, thank you, Kate, Evan, Paul. Hope you all enjoyed it. And thanks to everyone that's listening, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks for the next one.